We begin with today's commentary for August 26th. The BBC and mainstream media is obviously following the wishes of the U.S. and the United Kingdom governments by pretending that the elections in Afghanistan represent something other than window dressing. They began breathlessly reporting yesterday when only 10% of the votes had been counted. Today, it's up to a whopping 17%. The Afghans say it might take 6 weeks to count all the votes, so this story should linger for news media eternity. There are, of course, widespread reports of truly comical election fraud, all favoring the incumbent American puppet, Hamid Karzai. No surprises there, as it's his government that's putting on the election. So rabble-rousing is going to go way out on a limb and predict the results. You heard it here first, folks. Hamid Karzai will win, and it won't mean a damn thing, as his government controls his capital of Kabul and some territory surrounding the city and little else. The rest of his country is controlled by local warlords or the Taliban insurgents. But they did have an election. Whoopee. But the election does serve an important function in the U.S. The media doesn't have to report the sordid details in Washington, D.C., as the high poobahs work to disembowel any meaningful health reform. Speaking of health care reform, some comments from San Francisco Chronicle readers on the possible health care reforms. The first one, I know all the people that say a public option is socialism are promising not to use Medicare, public roads, student loans, police, firefighters, public schools, post offices, municipal water, and etc., right? And then there's this comment. California has a public option that works fine since 1911. It's the State Compensation Insurance Fund. Back then, insurers hated the idea. Illinois' insurer, Frederick Draper, said, quote, any state-funded program would add another elaborate and expensive army of officials to the state payroll to wipe out of existence a well-organized and operated line of private enterprises because a group of socialists and allied social reformers have appointed themselves our social guides, close quote. Does that sound familiar? Competition from the fund spurred the private insurers to slash rates. One company cuts rates by 30%. Others offered their customers free service for a month, or similar enticements. Since its founding, it has not lost money. During the Great Depression, when California was paying its debts with IOUs, the fund was paying cash for workers' claims. Despite the insurers' initial fears, the fund never became a monopoly. It did not bankrupt the state, wipe out the private sector out of existence, or usher in an era of socialism. Okay, now let's listen to a comment from Tom Hartman. He has a solution so simple and elegant that one has to question why it will never happen. This is Tom Hartman, and it was in commondreams.org. Dear President Obama, I understand you're thinking of dumping your public option because of all the demagoguery by Sarah Palin and Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich and their crowd on right-wing radio and Fox. Fine. Good idea, in fact. Instead, let's make it simple. Please let us buy into Medicare. It would be so easy. You don't have to reinvent the wheel with this so-called public option. That's a whole new program from the ground up. Medicare already exists. It works. Some people will like it, others won't, just like the post office versus FedEx analogy you're so comfortable with. Just pass a simple bill. It could probably be just a few lines, like when Medicare was expanded to include disabled people, that says that any American citizen can buy into the program at a rate to be set by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Department of Health and Human Services, which reflects the actual costs of us to buy into it. So it's revenue neutral. To make it available to people of low income, raise the rate slightly for all current non-eligible people, like me, under 65, to cover the costs of below 200% of the poverty people. Revenue neutral again. Most of us will do damn near anything to get out from under the thumbs of the multimillionaire CEOs who are running our current insurance programs. Sign me up. This lets you blow up all the rumors about death panels and grandma and everything else. Everybody knows what Medicare is. Those who scorn it can go to Blue Cross. Those who like it can buy into it. Simplicity itself. Of course, we'd like a few fixes, like letting Medicare renegotiate drug prices and filling some of the holes Republicans and AARP and the big insurance lobbyists have drilled into Medicare so people have to buy supplemental insurance. But that can wait for the second round. Let's get this done first. Simple stuff. Medicare for anyone who wants it. Private health insurance for those who don't. Easy message. Even Max Baucus and Chuck Grassley can understand it. Sarah Palin can buy into it or ignore it. No death panels, no granny plugs, nothing. Just a few sentences. Replace the quote, "you must be disabled or 65, close quote, with, "here's what it'll cost you if you want to buy in, and here's the sliding scale of subsidies we'll give you if you're poor, paid for by everyone else who's buying in." You could roll back the Reagan tax cuts and make it all free, but that's another rant. We elected you because we expected you to have the courage of your convictions. Here's how. Not the single-payer Medicare for all that many of us would prefer, but a simple Medicare for anybody who wants to buy in. Respectively, Tom Hartman. And now for today's final words on our elected representative's semi-serious attempt at health care reform, we turn to our own Mark Stannard. Here's his take from his local views of the news. He usually tells it better than anyone I know. His perceptions are insightful, and he writes better than almost anyone out there. In case you missed his recent local views of the news, a regular feature on KVMR, this is his summation on President Hopeful's fiasco of health care reform. Healthcare still is the story, but a story in which the climax is past, and a long, painful, anticlimactic ending awaits us. Single payer never was in the discussion. You knew that. The government option was the bait they dangled in front of the single payer fans, a constituency which included the majority of citizens back before the Kool-Aid was served. Now the Obama administration is abandoning even that scant trace of real healthcare reform. In fact, no one at the White House even says the words healthcare reform anymore. Now it's health insurance reform. Now we'll stand around scratching our heads and our tails while a 30-pound healthcare bill picks its way through the congressional labyrinth. And it's not too far out on a limb to predict that, when it's all over, the Democrats will be crowing about their successful reform and everything will be the same. The same corporations still will be making the same billions in profits. No one will be paying any less for health care, and a lot of people still won't be able to afford it. That uniquely American approach to improving health care for which everyone has been looking is quite simple. Just make it even more profitable. The most likely reforms will be in the way corporate medicine will pick our pockets. The profit motive no longer is thinly veiled, it's front and center. The term health insurance is inclusive of things like managed care, HMOs, and vertical systems like Kaiser, and everyone understands the theory of insurance. Everyone also understands that the fewer claims an insurance company pays, the more money it makes. Having scored an easy win in the reform battle, the insurers won't be trying to persuade anyone that they're in the business of protecting our health. They'll be telling us bluntly that they're denying our claims so they can make more money. The insurers and the drug companies will continue to shamelessly gouge us on the prices just because they can. Doctors will continue to hide behind the Hippocratic Oath while the real medical decisions are made by people whose degrees on the wall say MBA, not MD. By selling out on health care, President I'm Not Bush has delivered the clear message that he no longer needs any support or approval from the left side of the political spectrum. All those people who called themselves progressives have been looking the other way while U.S. policy in the Middle East continues on the military path. But Obama's progressive pretensions have now passed. The last word still belongs, as always, to the corporate money that permeates Washington, no matter which party works in the White House. Fooled again. And if it works for medicine, maybe it'll work for fossil fuels, too. The American Petroleum Institute sent a letter to all the major oil companies asking them to recruit employees and retirees to stage public demonstrations later this month against climate change legislation. Let the planet fry, but get out there and protect your employer's profits. That was Mark Stannard in his local views of the news. So, a brief question to folks listening in from all over America. Are your representatives following your wishes or voting with their wallets? If they aren't, what are you going to do about it? Next item. Just in case you thought Washington, D.C., under Democratic leadership, had any interest in cleaning up tax and financial fraud, now hear this. Washington, D.C. Today, whistleblower Bradley C. Birkenfeld was sentenced to 3 years and 4 months in prison for assisting a client at UBS to evade taxes. UBS is a Swiss bank. Mr. Birkenfeld, on his own initiative, blew the whistle on UBS, Switzerland's largest bank. His disclosure and cooperation with U.S. authorities provided inside information into the bank's conduct and began the dismantling of the historic secrecy of Swiss banks. In fact, by blowing the whistle, Mr. Birkenfeld's disclosure directly led to a groundbreaking legal settlement in which USB agreed to pay $780 million in fines, and UBS and the Swiss government have agreed to turn over the names of thousands of Americans suspected of tax evasion. Dean A. Zerbe, former tax counsel to the Senate Finance Committee, where he was the key staffer for writing the IRS tax whistleblower laws, and now NWC special counsel, released the following statement on Mr. Birkenfeld's sentence. Quote, "It stuns me that the reward for a whistleblower who shined the light on extensive tax fraud and corruption is being sent to jail. Without Mr. Birkenfeld coming forward, the U.S. would not be where it is today in cracking open secret Swiss bank accounts." Mr. Zerbe added, quote, "If the U.S. is serious about detecting fraud, they have to play ball with the insider, not throw them out of the stadium. The U.S. needs to recognize that you do not invite Boy Scouts when you're planning tax fraud. The U.S. decision to send to prison this whistleblower sends a terrible message to other potential whistleblowers and is a real setback in efforts to deal with tax and financial fraud." The next article, The Obama Double Standard. It's by David Sirota, smirkingchimp.com. As the White House continues to move towards dropping the public option, I want to dispel two important myths. The one about the administration's legal leverage and ideological outlook. Specifically, just in case you were under the illusion that the Obama White House has no ability to play political hardball and or treats progressive and corporate Democrats equally, I wanted to just highlight this crystal clear contrast. The first is from the Wall Street Journal. "Obama won't punish blue dogs," Jarrett says. Valerie Jarrett, the president's senior advisor, said that President Barack Obama will not punish blue dog Democrats for their role in slowing the health care debate. Then we have this one from the Huffington Post. "White House browbeats Democratic freshman on war money. You'll never hear from us again." The White House is playing hardball with Democrats who intend to vote against the supplemental war spending bill, threatening freshmen who oppose it that they won't get help with re-election and will be cut off from the White House, Representative Lynn Woolsey, California, said on Friday. "We're not going to help you. You'll never hear from us again," Woolsey said the White House is telling freshmen. The double standard doesn't get any more clear than that, and it's predictable. Indeed, this is what you get from a White House that is run by Rahm Emanuel and former Baucus staffer and famous corporate bumlicker Jim Messina. A White House that plays hardball, but only with progressives. It's a White House that ignores its president's own progressive campaign rhetoric, treats congressional progressives as second-class citizens, and treats corporate shills as the most important players of all. Next item. This story has huge ramifications. On August 1st, Democracy Unlimited filed a brief in the U.S. Supreme Court challenging corporate personhood, which is the illegitimate and undemocratic legal doctrine which allows courts to overturn democratically elected laws that attempt to control corporate harm and abuse. A spokesman for the group filing the brief stated, quote, "The notion that corporations have the same speech rights as people under our Bill of Rights is contrary to the words, history, spirit, and intent of our Constitution. The organizations that joined to bring these arguments to the court have worked with others for many years to empower democratic self-government. They remind us that corporations do not vote, speak, or act as people do, but are products of government policy to achieve economic and charitable ends. As such, corporations need not be allowed to influence our elections. If Congress and state governments judge that such influence is detrimental to democracy." The Supreme Court is considering overturning federal campaign regulations for corporations, which were originally enacted in 1907, and they may soon overrule previous Supreme Court decisions that have upheld the constitutionality of legislative restrictions on corporate money and politics. The brief filed by Democracy Unlimited argues that corporations are legal entities created by state or federal law for economic, charitable, or other purposes, and were never intended to be included within the Constitution's Bill of Rights. The Supreme Court will be hearing the case in September. Let's be clear on this one. The issue before the court is to legitimize the absurdity of corporations having the same rights as people, in this case, the right to influence our elections. The brief mentioned is challenging that basic premise. The $64,000 question is, how will mainstream media, which of course is owned and controlled by the very corporations involved in the case, report this story, if it will be mentioned at all? Next item. Hey, I'm just curious. Our nation is filled with Vietnam War vets living on the fringes, who never really adjusted to life at home after what they experienced and perhaps committed while away at war. We're starting to be informed of young men returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who fail to adjust to life at home and commit violent crimes or suicide. They blame it on what they've seen and done while away at war. So far, I've not heard of any problems concerning our returning women warriors. Have you? Have they been protected from the dirty side of combat and the inevitable brutalities and atrocities? Or do our women returning from Iraq witness and even commit atrocities and then simply adjust better than the men and have no problem upon returning home? If so, does this then imply that women in the military can become less morally challenged killers than men? Which of course implies they might be better suited for the dirty side of house-to-house combat than men. Or does it imply that we're simply not being told about the returning women warriors who do not adjust and end up in mental institutions, or committing suicide, or violent crimes? Is this one more dirty little secret of our oil wars? I don't know. I just wonder. The time is 12:27. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Next item in my commentary. Oh, okay, we got a call. Let's go for that. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Please start over.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a good idea to buy in the Medicare. We just have to make sure that it's affordable to buy in. You know, maybe have a sliding scale for the middle class as well as the poor on the other end.
Yeah, that's
because that's one of the big issues is affordability to begin with. So
absolutely,
I think it's a good idea, but we just got to make sure that the cost is reasonable.
Okay, if you think it's a really good idea, my suggestion is you and everyone who agrees with you contact your representatives and demand that they do something.
Yeah,
they're supposed to be our representatives.
Definitely.
Okay,
there you go.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye bye. All right. Back to my commentary. Next item. For years, I've been baffled by cigarette smokers. I know it's an addiction. Everyone with an IQ above room temperature knows nicotine is addicting. And yet, as nicotine addicts die off from lung cancer and emphysema, more kids take their places and take up the habit. So the number of nicotine addicts seems to remain fairly constant. Be not fooled by living in California. In the world of nicotine addiction, we are an island. The rest of the country and the rest of the world smokes, often and heavily. And many of my own friends and acquaintances here in California, otherwise seemingly rational and sane people, continue to shorten their lives, interrupt their daily routines, and irritate their friends as they cater to and satisfy their addiction. So, for those of you who likewise wonder, what's up with this nicotine addiction phenomena, and why can't our civilization get beyond it? I offer this chapter from a book called The Tipping Point. The book's premise is that there are several factors which can begin a trend and influence people far beyond what one might expect. It might be a dynamic person who starts the trend, or a ripe situation. According to the author, the addiction to nicotine begins as an experiment, moves into a pastime, and for some poor souls, moves beyond that into an addiction. So here's Malcolm Gladwell's take from his book, The Tipping Point. It's rather lengthy, so you might want to sit back, get comfortable, and see if you can hear it out without the need to light up. This is from Chapter 7, Suicide, Smoking, and the Search for the Unsticky Cigarette. He began by speaking about teenage suicide in Micronesia, which had become an epidemic, and I'll omit that part. Thus, as suicide grows more frequent in these communities, the idea itself acquires a certain familiarity, if not fascination, to young men, and the lethality of the act seems to be trivialized. Especially amongst some younger boys, the suicide acts appear to have acquired an experimental, almost recreational element. There's something chilling about that passage. Suicide isn't supposed to be trivialized like this, but the truly chilling thing about it is how familiar it all seems. Here we have a contagious epidemic of self-destruction engaged in by youth in the spirit of experimentation, imitation, and rebellion. Here we have a mindless action that somehow amongst teenagers has become an important form of self-expression. In a strange way, the Micronesian teen suicide epidemic sounds an awful lot like the epidemic of teenage smoking in the West. Teenage smoking is one of the great baffling phenomena of modern life. No one really knows how to fight it, or even for that matter, what it is. The principal assumption of the anti-smoking movement has been that tobacco companies persuade teens to smoke by lying to them, by making smoking sound a lot more desirable and a lot less harmful than it really is. To address that problem, then, we've restricted and policed cigarette advertising, so it's a lot harder for tobacco companies to lie. We've raised the price of cigarettes and enforced the law against selling tobacco to minors, to try and make it much harder for teens to buy cigarettes. And we've run extensive public health campaigns on television and radio and in magazines to try and educate teens about the danger of smoking. It has become fairly obvious, however, that this approach isn't very effective. Why do we think, for example, that the key to fighting smoking is educating people about the risks of cigarettes? Harvard University economist W. Kip Viscusi recently asked a group of smokers to guess how many years of life, on average, smoking from the age of 21 onward would cost them. They guessed 9 years. The real answer is somewhere around 6 or 7 years. Smokers aren't smokers because they underestimate the risks of smoking. They smoke even though they overestimate the risks of smoking. My comment at this point, those statistics are, one can question them, but never mind, I think the point has been made. Back to this, the book. At the same time, it's not clear how effective it is to have adults tell teenagers that they shouldn't smoke. As any parent of a teenage child will tell you, the essential contrariness of adolescence suggests that the more adults inveigh against smoking and lecture teenagers about its dangers, the more teens, paradoxically, will want to try it. Sure enough, if you look at smoking trends over the past decades or so, this is exactly what's happened. The anti-smoking movement has never been louder or more prominent. Yet all signs suggest that amongst the young, the anti-smoking message is backfiring. Between 1993 and 97, the number of college students who smoked jumped... Okay, here he gives a bunch of percentages. So what? You get the point. There are few public health programs in recent years that have fallen as short of their missions as the war on smoking. The lesson here is not that we should give up trying to fight cigarettes. The point is simply that the way we have tended to think about the causes of smoking doesn't make a lot of sense. That's why the epidemic of suicide in Micronesia is so interesting and potentially relevant to the smoking problem. It gives us another way of trying to come to terms with youth smoking. What if smoking, instead of following the rational principles of the marketplace, follows the same kind of mysterious and complex social rules and rituals that govern teen suicide? If smoking really is an epidemic like Micronesian suicide, how does that change the way we ought to fight the problem? Okay, it's a very, very lengthy chapter, so I'm going to skip over some of his stuff. OK, Okay, so let's get into a little bit into the Micronesian suicide, because it does explain what he's trying, the point he's trying to make. In November of 66 came the death of R, the charismatic scion of one of the island's wealthiest families. R had been seeing two women and had fathered a one-month-old child with each of them. Unable to make up his mind between them, he hanged himself in romantic despair. At his funeral, his two lovers, learning of the existence of the other for the first time, fainted on his grave. We've got a call here, so I'm going to try one call, but I really don't want to interrupt this article. So let's see how pertinent it is. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Yeah, I just heard on Rush Limbaugh that a lady called in, said that there were about 20% of the people attending a John Dean town hall meeting that disagreed with him, so they yelled the whole time so that John Dean couldn't answer a single question. I would... Tom McClintock's coming to town in, within the next couple of weeks. I thought it'd be nice to ask him whether he thought it would be appropriate for if 20% of the audience disagreed with him, these liberal, wacko left-wingers, whether he would feel it would be appropriate for them to rant and rave the entire meeting.
Okay. I assume you're going to go to that meeting and pose that question to him?
I don't think I'll go to the meeting.
Okay.
All somebody right. else will have to.
Thanks for your call. Okay, back to my this study I'm reading, and I would appreciate no phone calls until I finish reading this. Okay, 3 days after this young man's death, there was another suicide. Okay, what the point he's trying to make is that the young man, the charismatic young man, was the tipping point, the salesperson, the one who sold this concept to others and then they followed along, the one whose experience overwrought the experience of those who followed him. The power of his personality and the circumstances of his death combined to make the force of his example endure years beyond his death. This was the beginnings of that teenage suicide epidemic in Micronesia. Does teen smoking follow the same logic? In order to find out more about the reasons teenagers smoke, I gave several hundred people a questionnaire asking them to describe their earliest experiences with cigarettes. This was not a scientific study. The sample wasn't representative of the United States. It was mostly people in their late 20s and early 30s living in big cities. Nonetheless, the answers were striking, principally because of how similar they all seemed. Smoking seemed to evoke a particular kind of childhood memory, vivid, precise, emotionally charged. One person's remember how she loved to open her grandmother's purse where she would encounter the soft smell of cheap Winstons and leather mixed with drugstore lipstick and cinnamon gum. Another remembers sitting in the back of a Chrysler sedan, smelling the wonderful mixture of sulfur and tobacco wafted out of the driver's window and into my nostrils. Smoking, overwhelmingly, was associated with the same thing to nearly everyone, sophistication. This was true even of people who now hated smoking, who now think it's a dirty and dangerous habit. The language of smoking, like the language of suicide, seems incredibly consistent. He then gives several examples of people giving their childhood memories. This is the shared language of smoking, and it is rich and expressive as the shared language of suicide. In this epidemic, as well, there are tipping people, salesmen, permission givers. Time and time again, the respondents to my survey described the particular individuals who initiated them into smoking in precisely the same way. Now here's one example I will read. When I was around 9 or 10, my parents got an English au pair girl, Maggie, who came and stayed with us one summer. She was maybe 20. She was very sexy and wore a bikini at the Campbell's pool. She was famous with the grown-up men for doing handstands in her bikini. Also, it was said her bikini top fell off when she dove. Mr. Carpenter would submerge whenever she jumped in. Maggie smoked, and I used to beg her to let me smoke, too. So Maggie would be a salesperson, a charismatic individual that would, and a peer, that would give permission to this young man to smoke. Another example. The first kid I knew who smoked was Billy G. We became friends in fifth grade when the major distinction on our suburban New Jersey town, jocks, heads, brains, were beginning to form. Billy was incredibly cool. He was the first kid to date girls, smoke cigarettes and pot, drink hard alcohol, and listen to druggy music. I even remember sitting upstairs in his sister's bedroom, separating the seeds out of some pot on the cover of a Grateful Dead album. The draw for me was the badness of it, and the adultness, and the way it proved the idea that you could be more than one thing at once. The first person who I remember smoking was a girl named Pam P. I met her when we were both in the 10th grade. We rode the school bus together in Great Neck, Long Island, and I remember thinking she was the coolest because she lived in an apartment. Great Neck didn't have many apartments back then. Pam seemed so much older than her 15 years. We used to sit in the back of the bus and blow smoke out the window. She taught me how to inhale, how to tie a man-tailored shirt at the waist to look cool, and how to wear lipstick. She had a leather jacket. The author then establishes a personality profile of the typical smoker. The significance of the smoking personality, I think, cannot be overstated. If you bundle all of these extroverts' traits together, defiance, sexual precocity, honesty, impulsiveness, indifference to the opinion of others, sensation-seeking, you come up with the almost perfect definition of the kind of person many adolescents are drawn to, Maggie the au pair, Pam P. on the school bus, Billy G. with his Grateful Dead records, were all deeply cool people. But they weren't cool because they smoked. They smoked because they were cool. The very same character traits of rebelliousness and impulsivity and risk-taking and indifference to the opinion of others and precocity that made them so compelling to their adolescent peers also made it almost inevitable that they would also be drawn to the ultimate expression of adolescent rebellion, risk-taking, impulsivity, indifference to others, and precocity, the cigarette. This may seem like a simple point, but it's absolutely essential to understanding why the war on smoking has stumbled so badly. Over the past decade, the anti-smoking movement has railed against the tobacco companies for making smoking cool, and has spent untold millions of dollars on public money trying to convince teenagers that smoking isn't cool. But that's not the point. Smoking was never cool. Smokers are cool. Smoking epidemics begin in precisely the same way that the suicide epidemic in Micronesia began, or word-of-mouth epidemics begin. Because of the extraordinary influence of Pam P. and Billy G. and Maggie and their equivalents. In this epidemic, as in all others, a very small group, a select few, are responsible for driving the epidemic forward. The teen smoking epidemic does not simply illustrate the law of the few, however. It is also a very good illustration of the stickiness factor. After all, the fact that overwhelming numbers of teenagers experiment with cigarettes as a result of their contacts with other teenagers is not, in and of itself, all that scary. The problem, the fact that it's turned smoking into public health enemy number one, is that many of those teenagers end up continuing their cigarette experiment until they get hooked. The smoking experience is so memorable and powerful for some people that they can't stop smoking. The habit sticks. It's important to keep the two concepts, contagiousness and stickiness, separate, because they follow very different patterns and suggest very different strategies. Contagiousness is in a larger part a function of the messenger. Stickiness is primarily a property of the message. Smoking is no different. Whether a teenager picks up the habit depends on whether he or she has contact with one of those salesmen who give teenagers permission to engage in deviant acts. But whether a teenager likes cigarettes enough to keep using them depends on a very different set of criteria. In a recent University of Michigan study, for example, a large group of people were polled about how they felt when they smoked their first cigarette. What we found is that for almost everyone, their initial experience with tobacco was somewhat aversive. But what sorted out the smokers-to-be from the never-again smokers is that the smokers-to-be derived some overall pleasure from the experience, like the feeling of a buzz or a heady, pleasurable feeling. The numbers are striking. Of the people who experimented with cigarettes a few times and then never smoked again, only about a quarter got any sort of pleasant high from their first cigarette. of the ex-smokers, people who smoked for a while but later managed to quit. About a third got a pleasurable buzz. Of people who were light smokers, about half remembered their first cigarette well. Of the heavy smokers, though, 78% remembered getting a good buzz from their first few puffs. The questions of how sticky smoking ends up being to any single person, in other words, depends a great deal on his or her own particular initial reaction to nicotine. This is a critical point, and one that's often lost in the heated rhetoric of the war on smoking. The tobacco industry, for instance, has been pilloried for years for denying that nicotine is addictive. That position, of course, is ridiculous. But the opposite notion often put forth by anti-smoking advocates, that nicotine is a deadly taskmaster that enslaves all who come in contact with it, is equally ridiculous. Of all the teenagers who experiment with cigarettes, only about a third ever go on to smoke regularly. Nicotine may be highly addictive, but it is only addictive in some people, some of the time. Most important, it turns out that even amongst those who smoke regularly, there are enormous differences in the stickiness of their habit. Smoking experts used to think that 90 to 95% of all those who smoke were regular smokers. But several years ago, the smoking question on the federal government's National Health Survey was made more specific, and researchers discovered to their astonishment that a fifth of all smokers don't smoke every day. There are millions of Americans, in other words, who manage to smoke regularly and not be hooked. People for whom smoking is contagious but not sticky. In the past few years, these chippers, as they've been dubbed, have been exhaustively studied, with the bulk of the work being done by His definition of a chipper is someone who smokes no more than five cigarettes a day, but who smokes at least 4 days a week. As he writes, chipper smoking varies considerably from day to day, and their smoking patterns often include days of not complete abstinence. Chippers reported little difficulty maintaining such casual abstinence and reportedly experienced almost no withdrawal symptoms when abstaining from smoking. Unlike regular smokers who smoke soon on waking up or to replenish the nicotine that's been cleared overnight, chippers go several hours before smoking their first cigarette of the day. In short, every indicator examined suggests that chippers are not addicted to nicotine and that their smoking is not driven by withdrawal relief or withdrawal avoidance. He calls chippers the equivalent of social drinkers. What distinguishes chippers from hardcore smokers? Probably genetic factors. University of Colorado took several groups of different strains of mice and injected each with steadily increasing amounts of nicotine. When nicotine reaches toxic levels in a mouse, nicotine, after all, is a poison, it has a seizure. Collins wanted to see whether different strains of mice could handle different amounts of nicotine. Sure enough, they could. The strain of mice most tolerant of nicotine could handle about 2 to 3 times as much as the drug as the strain that had seizures at the lower rate. It's about the same rate as alcohol, he says. Let's skip. Humans obviously aren't mice, and drinking nicotine from a bottle in a cage isn't the same as lighting up a Marlboro. But even if there is only a modest correlation between what goes on in mice brains and ours, these findings do seem to square with the previous study. The people who didn't get a buzz from their first cigarette and who found the whole experience so awful that they never smoked again are probably people whose bodies are acutely sensitive to nicotine, incapable of handling it in even the smallest doses. Chippers may be people who have the genes to derive pleasure from nicotine, but not the genes to handle it in large doses. Heavy smokers, meanwhile, may be people with the genes to do both. This is not to say that genes provide a total explanation for how much people smoke. Since nicotine is known to relieve boredom and stress, for example, people who are in boring or stressful situations are always going to smoke more than people who are not. It is simply to say that what makes smoking sticky is completely different from the kinds of things that make it contagious. If we're looking for tipping points in the war on smoking, then we need to decide which of these sides of the epidemic will have the most success attacking. Should we try to make smoking less contagious to stop the salesmen who spread the smoking virus, in this case the teenagers' peers? Or are we better off trying to make it less sticky to look for ways to turn all smokers into chippers? Let's deal with the issue of contagion first. There are two possible strategies for stopping the spread of smoking. The first is to prevent the permission givers, the Maggies and Billy G's, from smoking in the first place. This is clearly the most difficult path of all. The most independent, precocious, rebellious teens are hardly likely to be the most susceptible to rational health advice. The second possibility is to convince all those who look to people like Maggie and Billie G for permission that they should look elsewhere to get their cues as to what's cool, in this instance from adults. But this too is not easy. In fact, it well may be an even more difficult strategy than the first, for the simple reason that parents simply don't wield that kind of influence over children. This is a hard fact to believe, of course. Parents are powerfully invested in the idea that they can shape their children's personalities and behavior. But, as Judith Harris brilliantly argued in her 1998 book, The Nurturing Assumption, the evidence for this belief is sorely lacking. And then there's she cites evidence here that the social environment does not really make real difference in the way our children end up as adults. There was a survey that was done with twins that established that. Okay, I'm going to skip over that because we're running low on time. The results strongly suggest that our environment plays as big, if not bigger, a role in heredity in shaping personality and intelligence. What it is saying is that whatever that environmental influences is, it doesn't have a lot to do with parents. It's something else. And what Judith Harris argues is that something else is the influence of peers. Why, Harris asks, do the children of recent immigrants almost never retain the accent of their parents? How is it the children of deaf parents manage to learn how to speak as well and as quickly as children whose parents speak to them from the day they were born? The answer has always been that language is a skill acquired laterally, that what children pick up from other children is as, or more important, in the acquisition of language as what they pick up at the home. What Harris argues is that this is also true more generally, that the environmental influence that helps children become who they are, that shapes their character and personality, is their peer group. This argument has understandably sparked a great deal of controversy in the popular press. There are legitimates arguing about where and how far it can be applied. But there's no question it has a great deal of relevance to the teenage smoking issue. The children of smokers are more than twice as likely to smoke as the children of non-smokers. That's a well-known fact. But to follow Harris's logic, that does not mean their parents who smoke around their children set an example that their kids follow. It simply means that smokers' children have inherited genes from their parents that predispose them toward nicotine addiction. Indeed, studies of adopted children have shown that those raised by smokers are no more likely to end up as smokers themselves than those raised by non-smokers. Okay. So they're saying that the process by which teenagers get infected with their smoking habit is entirely bound up in peer group. It's not about mimicking adult behavior, which is why teenage smoking is rising at a time when adult smoking is falling. Teenage smoking is about being a teenager, about sharing in the emotional experience and expressive language and rituals of adolescence, which are as impenetrable and irrational to outsiders as the rituals of adolescent suicide in Micronesia. How, under the circumstances, can we expect any adult intervention to make an impact? Telling teenagers about the health risks of smoking, it will make you wrinkled, it will make you impotent, it will make you dead, is useless. That's adult propaganda. These are adult arguments. It is because adults don't approve of smoking, because there's something dangerous and disreputable about it, that teenagers want to do it. If trying to thwart the efforts of salesmen, if trying to intervene in the internal world of adolescence doesn't seem like a particularly effective strategy against smoking, then what about stickiness? Here, the search for tipping points is very different. We suspect, as I wrote previously, that one of the reasons some experimenters never smoke again and some turn into lifelong addicts is that human beings may have different innate tolerances for nicotine. In a perfect world, we would give heavy smokers a pill that lowered their tolerance to the level of, say, a chipper. This would be a wonderful way of stripping smoking of its stickiness. Unfortunately, we don't know how to do that. What we do have is the nicotine patch, which delivers a slow and steady dose of nicotine so that smokers don't have to turn to the dangers of cigarettes to get their fix. That's an anti-sticky strategy that has helped millions of smokers. But it is fairly clear that the patch is far from perfect. The most exhilarating way for an addict to get his fix is in the form of a hit, a high dose delivered quickly that overwhelms the senses. Heroin users don't put themselves on a heroin intravenous drip. They shoot up 2 or 3 times a day, injecting a huge dose all at once. Smokers, on a lesser scale, do the same. They get a jolt from a cigarette, then pause, then get another jolt. The patch, though it gives you a steady dose of the drug over the course of the day, which is a pretty boring way to ingest nicotine. The patch seems no more a tipping point in the fight against smoking epidemic than Slim Fast milkshakes are a tipping point in the fight against obesity. So is there a better candidate? There are a number of theories as to why smoking matches up so strongly with emotional problems. The first is that the same kinds of things that would make someone susceptible to the contagious effects of smoking, low self-esteem, say, or an unhealthy and unhappy home life, are also the kinds of things that contribute to depression. More tantalizing, though, is some preliminary evidence that the two problems might have the same genetic root. For example, depression is believed to be the result, at least part, of a problem in the production of certain key brain chemicals. And then they go into the brain chemicals. Drugs like Zoloft and Prozac work because they prompt the brain to produce more serotonin. They compensate, in other words, for the deficit of serotonin that some depressed people suffer from. Nicotine appears to do exactly the same thing with the other two key neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine. I know I'm mispronouncing that. Somebody's going to phone and tell me. Those smokers who are depressed, in short, are essentially using tobacco as a cheap way of treating their own depression, of boosting the level of brain chemicals they need to function normally. The effect is strong enough that when smokers with a history of psychiatric problems give up cigarettes, they run a sizable risk of relapsing into depression. Here is stickiness with a vengeance. Not only do some smokers find it hard to quit because they're addicted to nicotine, but also because without nicotine, they run the risk of a debilitating psychiatric illness. Okay, looks like I'm about out of time here. Too bad. There's more to this. Okay, so one of his take-home lessons for this, since we're about out of time, is that if we could control the actual content, chemical content of cigarettes, then we might be able to produce a level of nicotine ingestion that would be therapeutic but avoid addiction. We're about out of time. Caller, you're live on the air. Please be brief.
Hello, is that me?
Please be brief. We're about out of time.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to mention something, Chamba. You were talking about the looking for a dovetail between addiction and stickiness.
Right.
I actually quit smoking four times before I was actually able to quit. And,
okay.
And every time that I took it up again, it was a time in my life that was extremely stressful.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that smokers get from cigarettes is stress relief.
Sure.
Okay. And just putting this onto the teenage epidemic, you know, teenagers spend their childhood in lockstep to what adults are telling them to do. And when they become teenagers, I'm just postulating that possibly nonconformity is actually a release of stress for them.
Okay. Listen, we're out of time.
Yeah, okay.
It sounds like this might be an interesting discussion. Why don't we try continuing in next week?
All right. Thank
okay,
you very much.
So if you have further comments, please call in next week.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, so I didn't quite judge how long that would take to read, so I ran out of time with it. Let us thank Grass Valley Hydro Garden, serving the hydroponic and organic gardening needs of Nevada County since 2000. Grass Valley Hydro Garden offers sun system and hydroform lighting, organic soils, fertilizers, ventilation, and hydroponic systems. Grass Valley Hydro Garden, 12506 Loma Rica Drive. Thanks also to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service using sunshine, wind, and water to meet local power needs. Their specialties include on-site consultations, financial cost-benefit analysis, and guidance from education to installation. www.planitsolar.com 530-432-3776. Okay, I think I got time to cram this one. And this one is for all you tool users and for those of you wanting to give tools as gifts. It's a handy tool glossary. A straight screwdriver. It's a tool for opening paint cans, sometimes used to convert common slotted screws into non-removable screws. Drill press is a tall, upright machine useful for suddenly snatching objects you're trying to drill out of your hands so that they smack you in the chest. An electric hand drill is normally used for spinning pop rivets in their holes until you die of old age. A skill saw is a portable cutting tool used to make studs too short. A hacksaw is one of a family of cutting tools built on the Ouija board principle. It transforms human energy into a crooked, unpredictable motion, and the more you attempt to influence its course, the more dismal your future becomes. Table saw.